one of the things that I see on the cap table. HackVC, Polychain, DAO 5 are all in the cap table. Is it just a relationship thing? Because you guys are doing BD together.
There's like a group of funds that kind of invest in this Solana view of the world. There's a group of funds that invest in the modular Ethereum view of the world. Maybe we're a little bit more.
Tegan Salini, founder of DAO 5, an experimental crypto investment manager with over 300 million in assets and a unique vision to convert into a founder-owned DAO. DAO 5 was an early investor in cutting-edge crypto protocols, including Parachain, BitTensor, EigenLayer, Story Protocol, AltLayer, and Movement Labs, to name a few. Tegan's investment approach reflects a deep belief in the importance of supporting founders, first and foremost. Before launching DAO 5, Tegan was an early general partner at Polychain Capital. Is there a term sheet that you recall issued by someone that just had like funny clauses and that you thought were like, oh wow, this is very unique and slightly disturbing?
At one point with the Parachain founders, I was like deep in a negotiation about some stuff in the contract, and it was the tone was getting a little bit tense. I remember just going back and forth with Papa and Smokey, and we were kind of at an impasse, and I was like, you know what, to lighten the mood, I'm gonna like propose something funny. So we put some language in a side letter that says if certain metrics are hit for the fund on the Parachain investment, I'm going to get a Bong Bears tattoo on my body. So that's literally in the contract today.
So what's your secret sauce for spotting these projects early and maybe these trends early?
First off, you have to be in the weeds. Like, you can't just armchair philosophize in crypto on Twitter all day and expect the best deals to come to you. I think the closer you can get to ground level, the more important that is in spotting things early. And relationships with founders is very critical in that process. If you were going to start a new company today, the first people you would talk to as an idea board for your proposal and kind of like where you would get feedback first is other founders, you know. It's not like going to the funds first. So if you can get closer to that inception point, you're definitely going to see more things. We try to focus where other people are not as excited yet. So one example is just like decentralized science. There's not much of an industry around it. Funny enough, that reminds me a little bit of the Olympus DAO forks of the early days, like Temple DAO and Kalima and things like that. I remember like we wanted to get involved early and join the Discord, and everyone was just speculating on how you can get an airdrop or join. And I think Sia, our head of operations, had to like send feet pictures in the Discord to get the airdrop. So nothing's off the table for DAO 5.
Hey, Tegan. Welcome to the Open Metaverse Show.
Thank you for having me, Mehdi.
To kick things off, tell me who's Tegan and how did he get into crypto?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, where to begin? So I grew up in Toronto, Canada. People don't really know this, but Toronto's pretty core to the story of Ethereum. Vitalik went to Waterloo University, which is just like an hour or two outside of Toronto. And a lot of the early founders and early community people were kind of in that adjacent area. And yeah, growing up, I was kind of into the tech space always. When I was in college, before I later went on to law school, I worked briefly for a venture capitalist in Canada. This was in the 2010 era where like the iOS App Store was very new and the whole innovation wave was porting Web 1 to Web 2 with social and mobile. But then that I kind of ended up leaving after a year, went to law school, decided to pursue corporate law and build a core skill set. And then when I graduated law school and started working, I kind of wanted to focus on tech and find an emerging area that I found very interesting and fell into Ethereum. Started going to meetups, started going to hackathons and conferences. And yeah, I was just very captivated by what was happening. Truth be told, my first knee-jerk reaction was that this seems like a scam. I think having gone through law school and worked as a corporate lawyer in securities law, I was a little bit indoctrinated to see with a very like judgmental lens what are blue chip regulated financial assets and what seems like a very different framework. But eventually, as I started reading and learning more what was happening during the ICO tokenization wave of 2017, I got red-pilled. And funny enough for me, the thing that actually opened my mind was the DAO. And the DAO was a failure. Like the DAO hack in 2016, by no accounts is like the thing that people were getting excited about. But to me, that was very intuitive that DAOs could one day solve a lot of the problems we have with public companies, and just felt like the next technological innovation wave around corporate structures and business entities in the future.
From you turning from lawyer, getting into the whole ICO boom side of things in crypto, tell me a little bit more about the vibes and the scene around the ICO boom. What were some of the things you learned and and some of the things that you thought didn't make sense back then?
Yeah. So I think working as a junior corporate lawyer, especially on securities offerings, you spend like countless nights reading these 100-page prospectuses, multi-100-page prospectuses, marking up little typos and data point nitpicks that for a document that like fundamentally no retail investor is going to read. And you see how expensive and burdensome the cost of going public is to have true price discovery and raise money from a broader cohort of investors. So as I saw ICOs basically digitize this whole process, make it egalitarian, free for the public to participate in these crowd sales, it just felt much more efficient and a huge evolution. That's what captivated me initially. And the first thing I tried to do was kind of build a law practice around supporting ICO work. But very quickly, the more time I spent in the Ethereum community, the more I felt like, you know, to ride this wave as a lawyer is not the most interesting way to participate in what's happening here. And it just didn't scratch the itch. So I kind of quit my job without a plan, started writing a lot about kind of interesting corporate governance issues in crypto. This is when the initial thought leadership around tokenization was starting to take place on Medium and places like that in 2017. And yeah, I just dove in with both feet.
So initially when you joined, you were advising project more on the legal side of things. And then you kind of got the bug and you were impressed with some of the innovation that was happening in the ecosystem and you wanted to get closer to action. I think after that you joined Polychain. So tell me a little bit about that. Like, how were you recruited in Polychain?
Yeah, good question. So as I mentioned, in the 2017 era, I was just like super interested with what was happening, started thinking up unique viewpoints on the legal side and the future of DAOs and publishing some of these essays and thought pieces. So I think it was a late 2017 piece I wrote about how one day DAOs would innovate the like corporate firm structure as we knew it. I saw firsthand, working as a junior lawyer, all the alignment issues and misalignment issues that take place in a firm like a law firm. And I thought, you know, DAOs will one day blend the lines of what we think of as like employees and owners, equity owners and creditors. All of these divisions are ultimately going to be programmatic and governed by this token ownership. And that piece, I think, caught the eye of Polychain. They invited me in to interview and I ended up joining and the rest is history.
And that piece was on Medium or on Twitter? Where
was
that piece?
It was in Coindesk. Like an end of year reflection. Yeah.
Very cool. And how did the interview process go? Like, do you remember what were some of the things that were asked and maybe what were some of the things that impressed them that kind of led to the job offer?
Yeah, good question. I think one thing is the industry was very small at the time. Some of the teams I was being very scrappy to help with corporate governance, with like fundraising, with legal feedback, they were in the Polychain portfolio. So I was already kind of adding support to their portfolio and they thought naturally, hey, if this person's a culture fit, he should just do this under the Polychain banner so we can provide a more formalized portfolio support function. Then the legal side was also interesting. I think that gave me a little bit of an edge to get recruited because I think in the early 2017, mid-2017 era, there were like very few corporate lawyers that knew anything about crypto that also didn't dismiss it as a scam. And I kind of initially did that, but then eventually my mind opened up and I saw the truth and the potential. But I think having that skill set also added a lot of value. So I met with the team and it felt like a good culture fit. So I left Toronto and moved to SF to join
Polychain. And before that Coindesk article, have you had the chance to meet any of the Polychain team in the conference? Or was it more like they got a reference check from some of the portfolio companies, they liked your skills and they also loved the article that you wrote on Coindesk?
I think at one conference, I like saw Olaf in the bathroom and said, what's up? And I'm like, I love the stuff you do and it's really cool. And he said, thanks, and left. That was one meeting. But there was an early partner there that I started to build a bit of a rapport with the public writing and support to portfolio companies. So I had a few soft contact points, but it all got formalized in late December when I joined.
Yeah, I think this is very interesting. I think this is also a lesson for aspiring investors that wants to join the venture scene within crypto to actually start helping out the portfolio, get those references in, and then those portfolio can then help you get the job. So basically, you have to get your hands dirty and you have to add value in order to become an investor at a good firm. So I think this is very valuable.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think even in like the traditional VC world, for instance, if you're a senior person and you want to join Sequoia as a partner, I've heard things where like it can be in 1 year interview process almost. It's like a long journey to building a relationship because ultimately when you join, you get a voice at that table and that's very, very valuable and needs to be vetted up front. So I think for anyone jumping into the space, they should be willing to just experiment and play around with things and volunteer some time before looking for that job, ultimately. At least in my instance, that's what made all the difference and helped.
Super cool. Yeah. And when you were at Polychain, what were some of the investments you led there?
Yeah, good question. In the early days of Polychain, it was a little bit more egalitarian. It wasn't like a traditional VC. It felt more like a startup where firm-wide, we split up investments quite a bit. But I can tell you some of the ones I spent a lot of time on early. The Avalanche seed deal in, I think, 2018. Not as popular to say, but the Luna seed deal I was very involved in. After, I think, the Series A of Definity or ICP token was in 2018, I would spend a lot of time working with them. And yeah, a handful of others like that. It was kind of during the Alt L1 wave of 2018 where a lot of the innovation was around new consensus protocols. Those were some of the deals we spent a lot of time on.
And what was the commonality in terms of the founder with all of those deals? Was there a certain pattern in those deals in terms of thesis or a certain pattern with the founders that kind of excited you with all of these deals? Kind of feel like some of these deals also did ICOs, so maybe there is something there as well.
Yeah. Well, I guess you think of the history of crypto starting in 2017, 2018 with all of these new platforms being built. Fundamentally, the task was building low-level protocols. So founders were much more like low-level engineers, academics, theorizing how you can build a new platform that has XYZ properties. So there was kind of an academic and deep tech flair to the whole thing. There weren't as many consumer founders. It wasn't like as much of a relevant skill set because we were still in the early days of building crypto infra. But I think that founder prototype or archetype of an individual is something that inspired the type of deals that we do at DAO5 as well, which we'll get into.
And with those deals, were these inbound or did you hunt them in maybe conferences? Were there founder references? Did you reach out to them on Twitter? Like with all the three you mentioned, Avalanche, Luna, Definity, how did that came to your desk?
It was an incredibly small industry at the time. I think Polychain was one of the only crypto native venture funds. Like there were other venture funds in the space, but I feel like it was small enough that we just got a first look at everything at the time. And again, it would really just start from a research paper. For instance, some new consensus algorithm released or described in a white paper that's come out, we would first dive in and review it and then reach out to the academics that created it with a view to ultimately commercialize or help build a project around that research.
When you first invested in these deals, did they pivot afterwards or was it the same thing what they are now or when they were?
Yeah, a few pivoted, still with the same broad direction. But then again, the details of the infrastructure and design, I think things like that tend to change and evolve over cycles. But really, you think of it as like there are stages in the history of crypto. And at that point, we just needed more infra. There needed to be more experimentation on how to build scalable, generalized platforms like Ethereum. And some of these teams did that through consensus. Others wrote new smart contracting languages. It was like different bets and experiments going on in sync.
And was there a particular deal that at that moment you had very high conviction on and you led the round and maybe it produced the highest ROI? Even if it didn't produce the highest ROI, was there one deal that you liked the most and maybe put a lot of energy in, put a lot of your skin in the game in terms of helping the founder out?
Yeah, I think for me, that was Definity. I was a big believer in ICP. And this idea of like breaking it down into three evolutions of blockchain. And first you had Bitcoin as kind of this hard money asset and pure financial transfer. Ethereum with the ability to write more complex, like DeFi driven and smart contracts that support financial use cases. And then Definity, which would be like the decentralization of compute itself. And it's funny because this was an idea in 2018, but then it's almost come full circle with AI and a lot of the DPIN supporting like NPC. Decentralized compute and MPC. Yeah. So that one was a vision that was very big and captivated me. I think we didn't really end up with the outcome we expected at the time, but directionally and thesis wise, it was very correct.
Yeah. And what were there any lessons with the token launches and viewpoints now? I know there are different platforms now for compute. How has your view changed on Definity over the period of time? And what were some of the lessons you learned from the Definity launch? Because it was a very interesting launch.
Oh, man. Don't want to go too into that one. But I will say there's been a lot of lessons on tokenization and token launches. I think to really learn them, you have to go through multiple cycles. You have to go through these like crazy bulls where you think the momentum will never stop and you can sell anything through it. through an ICO or token distribution, and then another bear where you question if it'll survive and if the space will truly ever come back. And I think after you've gone through a few of these, you start to notice things like ICOs were a bit of a phenomenon of 2017, 2018, but token distributions come back in different forms in each cycle. It kind of like kicked off as yield farming and liquidity farming in DeFi of 2020. And then NFT sales are an extension of that, and maybe now like restaking to earn airdrops, things like this. So token distributions come in different forms in each cycle, and you should always be looking for new ways to do the job better.
We'll touch on DeepIn. I think that's a novel capital formation.
Absolutely.
We'll touch that later. Walk me through your journey. Like, why did you leave Polychain to start DAO5? And what is DAO5?
Yeah, absolutely. On the first question, there's multiple things. I think naturally the people who are best suited to help build a company when it's like completely at ground level startup are not the best people necessarily to be the stewards of it once it gets bigger, a little bit more formal, regulated. It's not as like scrappy and young. So I just felt it wasn't a personal fit anymore. The other thing, and this is more macro, is this is like 2021, late 2021 I left. I could read the tea leaves that the regulatory environment in the US was getting very hostile. I was bearish about how three-letter agencies would treat crypto in the coming years. And I'm Canadian, I'm not American, so I figured if I could start a business and do it offshore, I would have a huge edge of not being directly under that purview. And then the third is, as I mentioned, the DAO was the thing that initially red-pilled me, and I always wanted to build something related to a DAO. So investing was my skill set. DAOs were kind of this like sci-fi interest I had, and I figured out maybe it would be interesting to combine the two in some way.
And how will it be combined? Like, what's the vision with DAO5 in terms of it becoming a DAO?
Okay, yeah, good question. And I feel like this is something that can be confusing often, but DAO5 today is a traditional crypto venture fund. We have LPs, we have a centralized management team, we make investments and deploy that capital on behalf of LPs. In the future, we're going to convert the investment manager, the company that I currently run, and we make the decisions on how to allocate capital. We're going to convert that into a DAO. That's going to be a multi-stage process. It'll start by having a tokenized ownership pool, a treasury of assets, a governance token behind it, a DAO5 token, and ownership across all of our founders in the fund, including ourselves and our advisors. And we're just trying to unlock the brain capital of our founders, who are the smartest people, much smarter than us at DAO5 and much more capable to participate and help guide decisions of the fund. So I think the problem with early investment DAOs is they haven't really figured out a way to get the incentives right. Often it results either in the DAO being far too centralized. It's not actually a DAO. It's like maybe the treasury is on chain and there's like a governance process, but really the decision making is like one or two people behind closed doors. Or it's truly decentralized, but it's a tragedy of the commons. It's a bit of a breakdown of incentives where nobody actually keeps participating because no single person has enough ownership or kind of like liability that they take on the work. We're trying to solve that through progressive decentralization. So it'll start as a small concentrated DAO, and gradually over multiple cycles of the fund, we'll give more and more ownership away to new portfolio founders, to new advisors, and expand it that way.
Yeah, asking for a friend if somebody wants to join that DAO in the future when the progressive centralization decentralization happens, what will the profile look like of folks joining, or what will be the process in terms of these are the KPIs that you need to hit to become part of the DAO?
Yeah, it's a great question. Unfortunately, the short answer is I don't know yet, but we 100% want a way for community to get involved and join. Maybe there's AI components of like an LLM asking you what you need to do or setting the requirements to qualify for an airdrop or participation, and then you do that. Funny enough, that reminds me a little bit of the Olympus DAO forks of the early days, like Temple DAO and Kalima and things like that. I remember like we wanted to get involved early and join the Discord, and everyone was just speculating on how you can get an airdrop or join. And I think Sia, our head of operations, had to like send feet pictures in the Discord to get the airdrop. So all to say, nothing's off the table for DAO5.
I need to go back to that Discord. Go back to that Discord and find it. Yeah, just crazy thought. Maybe the DAO could be a network state.
Another way of framing that is maybe like network states are just inherently DAOs, and all you really care about is some kind of ownership, some digital rights, and all of that can be enforced in a token with what you think of as like citizenship today.
I'm assuming with the current state of things in DAO5, you're the solo GP.
Yes.
So what are some of the challenges of firstly starting DAO5 and also maybe some of the challenges of being a solo GP?
One thing to caveat, we started as a solo GP. We're in the process of launching our second fund, which I'll get into in the coming weeks. It's we don't have enough to share yet, but we're kind of moving into a peer partnership with more people joining, with meaningful ownership. So started as a solo GP, but it's going to be more of a partnership over time. I guess there's inherent trade-offs with the decision of starting a fund as a solo GP versus a peer partnership. Obviously, you give up some things as a solo GP. You don't have the camaraderie, the two brains are better than one, sounding board for your ideas. Naturally, you can cover more of the space with two people. But I think the one thing that's important, and this is my view of the world at least, is that the best investor entities, the best investment funds, they're kind of benign dictatorships more than they are democracies. I don't think that the best deals are ones where you have four of four partners being a soft yes on the decision to invest. The best deals are usually ones where like one partner really loves it and believes deeply in it and the other three maybe don't get it. And you should definitely have a mechanism where a single partner can lead a deal, even if it's contrarian and the rest of the people in the investment team and the process don't understand. And you see this a lot in crypto. The ones that are maybe consensus good deals, that's usually like priced in. To get an outlier return or killer performance on a deal, it has to be counterintuitive at the time. And sometimes the minority are the only ones that see that. Yeah, some of the big ones we've done to date is Barrachain. We led the seed round. BitTensor, we're one of the biggest owners and most active funds and have been accumulating that for the past 3 or 4 years. Movement Labs, we led the seed round. Story Protocol, we were the first investor. And Exo Labs is one that's more recent, but we're very excited about and led the seed round. There's like 40 more, but we'll just start there.
Yeah. So we'll touch each one of them in terms of why you're bullish or what was the thesis behind them. But before we get to that, so what's your secret sauce for spotting these projects early and maybe these trends early?
Yeah, great question. First off, you have to be in the weeds. Like, you can't just armchair philosophize in crypto on Twitter all day and expect the best deals to come to you. I think the closer you can get to ground level, the more important that is in spotting things early. And relationships with founders is very critical in that process. If you were going to start a new company today, the first people you would talk to as an idea board for your proposal and kind of like where you would get feedback first is other founders, you know. It's not like going to the funds first. So if you can get closer to that inception point, you're definitely going to see more things. That's just in terms of getting the scope. There's then the problem of how do you win the deals? What's your pitch? How do you differentiate yourself? But that's the thing I think we fundamentally do well on. We're not as loud on Twitter. We're not kind of like thought leadership marketing ourselves as much. We're a bit more quiet in that sense. But in terms of founder communities and being active in the space, I think we try to be very close to ground floor.
I can attest to that. Some of the projects, we are also investors, right? Like Movement, Barrachain, and they have only good things to say. There's also one of the things that I see on the cap table. HackVC, Polychain, DAO5 are all in the cap table, but sometimes DAO5 is earlier. Is it just a relationship thing? Like, you guys are close, you guys are doing DD together. Like, why is that?
Yeah, I think it's more of a like manufactured pattern by certain anons, but that's okay. Like, I get it. Fundamentally, crypto's not that big. You're going to overlap on cap tables with others. And if you want to be more reductionist, you could say, hey, there's like a group of funds that kind of invest in this Solana view of the world. There's a group of funds that invest in the modular Ethereum view of the world. Maybe we're a little bit more in the latter category alongside Polychain and others. The key thing that we try to do is just be as early as possible. That's how we try to stand out from others.
So I think there are two school of thoughts, right? Like looking at the market size and structure versus the type of founder. In your view, what is important and what is something you like DAO5 optimizes for more?
The single most common thread in why we do a deal is founder quality. And on its face, this is a very generic statement. It's like, what does that mean? I start by thinking of it in terms of like, you can be very thesis driven in your investment approach, or you can be people driven. And the difference is like what stage you're investing to an extent. If you're investing in Series B and C, you probably need to really be focused on thesis and hard metrics of a company's success. If you're focusing on pre-seed and seed, it's really about the person because the idea is going to change and the metrics aren't there yet. And the unique thing about crypto is, as much as we think of key man risk on platforms being an issue, like is there too much risk tied to this one person in betting on X coin, it really does converge on cults of personality. I think, like, Murad said this in the meme coin context, but the same is true with L1s. Like, obviously, the Vitalik Halo is a big part of Ethereum's success. The Polygon Army loves Sandeep. Like, you can extrapolate this to any protocol, really. And having that conviction or that, like, secret formula as a founder where it's not even necessarily pure charisma. It's like you can actually be uncharismatic, but have something special about you that's captivating and can build a strong community around that. That's one of the most important things we've seen. So that's like the X factor, but then the other things are more obvious, like technical capabilities, background of the founder. Trustworthiness is a huge one. Trust is like the most important currency in crypto to be able to keep building companies and protocols over multiple cycles. So we look at all those things.
It makes total sense. It feels like if a founder is attracting you, it would be easier for them to attract talent, other capital, customers.
Very true. And we should be the more skeptical ones because we're professional investors. So if they're able to convince you, they'll probably be able to convince a community of other builders and retail participants and things like that.
Yeah. There are a few projects you mentioned that DAO 5 is invested in. Maybe let's just break them by one. Like, how did you find them? What was the thesis? What were some of the qualities you liked about the founder or the project itself? Maybe starting with Barrachain. I know you guys were very early, even way before they were thinking about the L1, the POL. What was the story there? And what were some of the things you liked about Smokey and the founding team?
Yeah, good question. Funny enough, this was the first deal we led as a fund. So it was kind of our first big bet. And I think in many ways, it's been the best one. So towards the end of 2021, I was super into DeFi 2.0 and Olympus DAO. Lost a lot of money in Olympus DAO. But I thought the experiment was super interesting. And in some version, I believe that Olympus DAO will come back in terms of protocol-owned liquidity being an important feature of how you build a strong DAO. Also, just like fundamentally, a DAO is just a treasury of assets that people are bullish on and governance with the right people. And that it kind of modeled my thinking of how I want DAO 5 to eventually transfer into a DAO. And I met the Barrachain founders because they were active in that community early on. I think they had just launched an NFT collection that kind of had similar rebasing properties to Olympus, Bong Bears. And through some just like friends in DeFi 2.0, I got introduced to the founders. And really to what we were saying earlier, what captivated me is we had a call and we went into the specifics of the protocol, but I just left with like such a buzz impression. Like I was just so impressed by the high energy they brought to the table. It was very captivating. And similar to the broader thesis about betting on people, even though they were anons and maybe I had less info and background on them than other deals, I felt like they were very, very charismatic and had that ability to corral strong community over time.
And with DAO 5, do you focus pre-seed seed or do you it the whole cycle, let's say A, B,
C? Mostly pre-seed and seed, but we do some liquid tokens. We make exceptions to that rule. There's a lot of flexibility, but our bread and butter has been pre-seed and seed.
Talking about flexibility, tell our audience the story that you were telling me about BitTensor, how you guys accumulated the position. And also tell me, how did you learn about that project that early?
Yeah, I learned about it when I was still at Polychain, and BitTensor was very young. So for context, this was like late 2021, early 2022. It was not an AI hype cycle. ChatGPT was still over a year away from coming out. And actually, the early crypto AI projects were very cringe. They didn't feel like they would accumulate a lot of value. It just felt like directional, buzzy, like convergence of tech, but nothing so fundamentally strong there. And with Jacob and the BitTensor founders, I just felt something very, very different speaking to them. The thing that really impressed me is the decision to launch it entirely as a fair launch token. So there was no pre-mine, no inside deals, no SAFTs, no token warrants.
They were still willing to do the DD, help you tell the project.
There was an active community. It was pretty small, and it was mostly AI people as opposed to crypto people, which culturally are very different. But the whole thing had a bit of the like academic and purity ethos of Bitcoin. The economics are entirely modeled after Bitcoin. So 21 million total supply. The rewards get halved on a same emission cycle similar to Bitcoin, but I believe it's compressed by 2x. And yeah, I think like fair launches have always been something that to me have been very, very bullish. It's obviously hard to get the incentives to do those because the founders have to mine their token alongside everyone else. And if you remember like Grin in 2021, but there was Mimblewimble paper and there were more experiments and hype around different fair launches, but you have a bit of a challenge onboarding miners early if there's like a cumbersome mining spec required or specialized hardware. But BitTensor had this quality to it where I felt it had a small community, but it was very strong and promising. And yeah, we just got into the Discord and started messaging miners manually, offering to buy their tokens before there was a single exchange listing. So you were kind of just making up prices, picking them out of thin air. But eventually there was this website like bittensor.exchange that had something that resembled a market price based on mashing together data of all the OTCs. And yeah, we just built up a position of over like 20 manual OTC trades.
Tell me about Story Protocol.
Yeah, Story, we were actually the first investor. I think when SY started the company, I was the first person who kind of spoke to him in the crypto space. And to me, that represented a fundamental change on the approach that everyone had been taking to crypto. There was a lot of saturation in metaverse and gaming assets in 2021, DeFi 2.0, more pure infra. And this was like a creative consumer application with a very novel approach. Let's treat IP as like this DAO-driven composable process where you can create and generate new creative IP by leveraging the wisdom of the crowd. And SY's last company, Radish, which he sold to Kakao for over like $450 million, that fundamentally did the same thing without a token. So if you have a provable expert and someone who can ship in one category that then sees the value in doing a Web3 version of that same thing, I think it's a bit of a no-brainer.
There are a few other protocols, amazing protocols in your portfolio. You were also early on EigenLayer. Yeah, tell me about the story there.
Yeah, like we're obviously believers in the brain capital of the Ethereum community, felt that this was very core and critical infrastructure to the expansion of Ethereum and using its economic security to extend to other applications and other chains.
Was it restaking initially, or was the first pitch was something different?
It was restaking. And yeah, through Polychain, I met them in the early days. But we didn't lead. We were just participants.
The two other projects, right, that you mentioned, Movement. Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was the story there? How did you find the founder, and what was that aha moment for you? Because you were very early there as well. And it's typically when you're speaking with the founder, it's 21, 20, or 22, it's tough to make a decision. What was something about him and then the project that kind of clicked?
As I said, like, I think everything has a trade-off. And with a very young founder, it's like you trade experience for that just unbridled energy. There's so much energy with a young founder and their ability to just like push forward and be completely singular in their focus.
Also, founder that lifts heavy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, dead weights are bullish for sure. But with Rushi, this is actually interesting because it's one of the few examples where like I was fixated on the idea even before meeting him. And obviously, we had lived through 2021. 10 billion plus in hacks across L2s, bridges, etc., DeFi platforms. And Move was this really promising framework and language to have more secure smart contracts, the ability to like get rid of re-entrancy bugs and basic flaws like that. So felt like Move was very promising as a technology and as a language, but didn't think there was as much upside in a new L1. So someone shipping Move to Ethereum and doing it with the right positioning, right community, I felt was like very promising prospect. And then I met Rushi at a conference, I think, in 2022, and we just really connected. I liked his energy, so I moved quickly on instinct and made an offer.
Amazing. What was the valuation when you came in?
I can't recall.
Tell me more about Exolabs. I haven't heard about that project. What is that project doing? Why are you excited about it? And the story there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So Exo is a more recent investment we made. It's one of the single companies I'm most excited about in all of crypto. Obviously, AI has played a very transformative role in the current narrative farming in crypto, but also just like increasing the TAM of the whole space and fundamentally changing the way the internet works. So there's been a lot of attempts at novel technologies that intersect between crypto and AI. I think Exo is one of those very, very obvious ones that can make a big impact. And fundamentally, it's virtualization software to run inference or training on local devices, edge devices. So you obviously have the renders and the IO nets of the world that are trying to kind of like corral these data centers with NVIDIA GPUs to join this network. Exo is trying to create something more resourceful, which is, can we actually just push inference and training to the edge, meaning mobile devices, iPhones, laptops? This has been pretty thoroughly tested on inference already and is working. I think we're now doing that same process with training. And it seems to be very, very promising. Exo also, like a couple of weeks ago, was the number two trending GitHub on all of GitHub. So the repo is very popular with both AI and crypto folks. Incredibly, incredibly smart founders. Mohammed and Alex both were Oxford PhDs in AI and robotics. They've actually built things in the world of atoms, which is very rare because everyone in crypto is kind of like enamored in bits. And yeah, I think that this is a very resourceful technology that's going to play a big role in the AI stack.
How did you meet the founder?
Through another founder, which speaks to the DAO vision. One of our founders in our portfolio introduced us. So it is a recursive view. Like, ultimately, the DAO, once we formalize incentives for founders to bring opportunities to the fund, I think you're going to see the most killer investment vehicle in all of crypto.
What are some of the trends and sectors you are bullish on right now, forming thesis around? Can be a sector that's already out there, or it could be a new sector or a category of its own. What are some of the things that are exciting you, maybe for your next fund and some of the unallocated ones from your current one?
Yep, good question. You know, we're in an interesting point in the market where there's almost like a lack of new narratives. And I think that's fine because narrative chasing isn't how you generate real returns. Like, I think there's some trades to do around that. But fundamentally, if you want venture scale returns, you have to focus on new ideas before they're like top of mind or obvious to the rest of the market. The thing that I most importantly focused on is kind of like, we're in a trend of deep financial nihilism, saying that all tech coins are bullshit and crypto is really just a asset industry masquerading as a tech industry. And I think that, like, I understand the grievance. I think there's a market infrastructure problem, which is very clear just by looking at the last like 10 large scale tech token launches. But I don't think meme coins are the answer to that. I think you're swapping one inside cabal for another inside cabal. And I think the free market will correct this over time. So once we figure out some equilibrium on what's the right amount of money to get into a new tech project and like what are the market dynamics of when it should launch and what valuation and can retail make money, that's going to lead to a much healthier market, I think. And yeah, in terms of like specific categories, again, we try to focus where other people are not as excited yet. So one example is just like decentralized science. There's not much of an industry around it. There's one of our portfolio founders hosts the meetup for DeSci NYC, which I think is the biggest DeSci community that exists today. And it's very early. But again, you look at capital S science and you see all of the industry-wide problems. Like, it's very hard to do non-consensus research and get funding for that. It's very politicized. And I think like decentralizing this and creating science DAOs is one of the interesting ways to solve these problems.
In terms of the path towards monetization, what are your thoughts there? Like, how can it's amazing, it's great, like intellectually seems interesting, but let's say if we solve this, is there a path to monetization? Like, what are your thoughts there?
That's a big question in crypto, and it tends to be an afterthought more than token. No, I'm kidding. I do think, for instance, if you're able to corral a community and incent them to provide very unique and accurate forms of data that doesn't exist. For instance, like, I always thought 23andMe should be a DAO. I bought 23andMe and had the kit sitting on my desk for like a year as I decided, hey, am I comfortable giving my data to this company? But if you could do like a FHE DAO and have all that data contributed in an encrypted pool and then run compute over it and train models, and all of the revenue unlocked from training models or using that data flows through to the providers, I think that's just like an intuitive and brilliant idea. But yeah, it's going to take crypto to get us there. It's not something that like 23andMe will do themselves. And yeah, I think that's one angle.
There are a few projects like that. They're not doing it with privacy, with FHE involved. I think there's Vana.
Vana, yeah.
There are a few data DAOs. I think Grass is kind of doing something similar, but it's slightly different. But yeah, the idea with FHE, I think, would be interesting. You have that privacy. Yeah.
But this question, just to broaden it, like, you have to ask, what is the path to monetization for any crypto platform? And for the last like 6 years, 7 years, it's been a token. But ultimately, we have to think of these things as profitable protocols. Yes. They have to be able to generate cash flows. And you have to be able to reason about the token value in a way where you can run a discounted cash flow model like you would any public company today.
Kind of makes sense with data DAOs, right? Like, you collect data collectively with consensus from a large source. You can upsell it to Web2 folks. You can sell it to Web3 folks and make cash flow, potentially use it to buy back token or whatever.
Yep. Or people just like, the SEC is not engaged in so much lawfare anymore, and we can just do a dividend and call it a dividend and stop doing this dance in crypto we do to
APY,
make,
native APY.
Exactly.
So you touched on FHE. Your thoughts on privacy technologies, like, what's your thesis there? Are you taking any bets in that vertical? Is there a timing risk? What are your thoughts there?
Yep. We have one big bet in privacy, a platform called Seismic. We're also big investors in Anoma, which I think Anoma itself will be the intense layer, but Namada, which is shipping first, is a kind of like a privacy network. I think privacy is one of those things that users tend to not appreciate until it's compromised. So it can be challenging from a user adoption standpoint, getting people excited about privacy itself. But I do think that when you take a step back and stop thinking of privacy as like, we need this for nefarious purposes or to hide what we're doing, and just realize that if we ever want to have a functional DAO or a business that operates on chain, you need privacy. Like, you can't run an on-chain business and pay your employees if every competitor can go on-chain and see how much you pay each employee and like undercut you and make offers. The same applies to any on-chain activity. I think Seismic is really exciting because they're the one team that's kind of like taking this very commercial-minded approach to privacy, not doing it for the pure cypherpunk dystopian view of the world, but saying we need privacy because if you want to do XYZ interaction on-chain or create any commercially viable crypto platform, privacy has to be one of the key features.
Why do you think historically there have been few attempts, it hasn't taken off? I think MPC is there. We also had a few other protocols. Why do you think historically it hasn't taken off? And in the next few years, the timing will be right.
For privacy coins?
Yes.
Well, I think like the historic ones have a bunch of issues, like required trusted setups, for example. So there's been bugs, like pretty major ones discovered in Monero, Zcash, the first wave. The other thing is regulatory. I think still in the mind of regulators, the only reason you would build a privacy chain is if you're evading taxes or funding terrorists or something like that. But I think this is just a process to, you can build fail-safe mechanisms for some of these problems while still enabling privacy for the like legit commercial use cases. So I just think like a more commercial-minded approach and a more pragmatic approach needs to be taken to privacy tech as opposed to like a purely ideological approach, which is more of the history of Tornado Cash and other platforms like that.
And in Mocha, we do a lot of gaming. Your thoughts there? I know we were discussing earlier, you did look into gaming in around 2018. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts now? Maybe what were your thoughts then and what are your thoughts now? Do you have any thesis around that? Or yeah, just would like to get a download of your thoughts there.
First things first, I love gaming. I'm a gamer myself. Grew up playing StarCraft very competitively and avidly. So I think it's always been an interest area. When I tried to apply that passion to investing in gaming, things were very different because the more I dug, the more I realized that it's very hard to distinguish what is skill and differentiation and what is just like luck or fate, being in the perfect place, the perfect time. This is especially true of like mobile casual gaming. Like if you remember when Angry Birds took over the world in like 2008, Angry Birds was like the 20th game to iterate on the exact same gameplay mechanics with different skins. And when I tried to apply that to crypto investing, I realized like it's very hard to build conviction. There is a common thread where if someone's delivered very well on high quality games before, you believe that they have the formula and are able to replicate that. That seems like a logical bet. But even some of the gaming entrepreneurs that I encouraged to build Web3 games, they ultimately passed because they felt like even their previous successes were maybe driven by luck. So I'm a big believer. I think it's going to be one of the magic onboarding mechanisms for crypto that really makes it mainstream. I actually think GTA 6 specifically, which is going to have a crypto component.
I've heard the same. I've heard the same.
That's going to be a game changer.
GTA 5 actually had these sort of things, which were off-chain. Like you could manipulate the stock market by blowing up a building or killing the founder and things like that. So I've heard and looked into different forums. I think there is a crypto element there.
Right. So I think like with gaming, the intuitive thing has been, hey, these marketplaces for skins and game assets, those should be decentralized. Good luck convincing publishers and IP owners to do that. When they have a closed ecosystem, they make all the money. They're not going to share that unless they're forced to. Where I think Web3 gaming is very, very cool is when the IP itself is owned by like a DAO. And by owning the token, if you mod the game and the mod becomes very popular, you capture a big amount of upside or you earn more tokens or something like that.
I think that's the thesis with on-chain gaming, fully on-chain games where mod becomes really, really important. And that's how other people can get involved when token has a purpose.
Yeah, and you see like big studios spend hundreds of millions of dollars, billions of dollars to keep these IPs alive and keep iterating on them. But if you could just leverage the crowd and create incentives for them to do that, I just think you can have like decentralized games that evolve and iterate as fast as Fortnite does.
I don't know if you remember Loot NFTs.
There
are a few projects that have come out of that. I think Magic DAO was Treasure. Mm-hmm. Came out of that. There were a couple of others. So
very cool experiment.
Yeah. I think there's something there. I think the bottom-up IP creation just hasn't taken off, but I think there's something there. Like,
yep.
There was some early evidence that this can take.
And even play-to-earn, there's something there. It just has to be done in, like, a slower, more sustainable way. It can't...
Pixels yep. is kind of doing that. It's one of those games that have onboarded about 1 million users, and they are sustainably doing that, where the sinks is matching the faucet, so it's not hyperinflationary.
Hmm.
And if you kind of think about it, a lot of deepens are kind of play to earn. It's just different
right.
type of play to earn.
Yeah.
We can get into that in a bit. Currently, I'm very bullish on deepen. Like, that's the sole sector I'm...
You know, me too.
Yeah.
I agree. And I think if you look at our portfolio today, you wouldn't be able to, like, pick out as many deepen investments. But I think fundamentally...
There was one, I think, WeatherXM. If I'm not mistaken.
No, we're not in WeatherXM. But EXO is kind of a deep end thing, but it's you're not like bootstrapping a network of new hardware, but you are taking the billions of edge devices that exist in the world, the laptops, and trying to connect them over some mesh network in a way. So I think you could think of deep end as using existing hardware, which is a little bit of the initial Filecoin vision as well. Like, there's already hardware.
So there are two categories, right? There's a physical one, and mm-hmm. there's a virtual network. So I think this kind of belongs in digital virtual networks.
Right.
Yeah.
But the big problem is bootstrapping new physical networks is a very difficult thing to do. And you see this in the history of DeepIn. Like, even the QWERTY keyboard, the modern keyboard, it's still built on a premise of this is the optimal keyboard so the keys don't jam together. Like, the letters that you need to use in sequence are actually deliberately far from one another. And we're still on this standard because it's very hard to activate the world to move to a better standard. That activation energy creates weird incentives. Like, the free market doesn't solve the problem. But DeepIn, if you're creating an inflationary token, you're building enough momentum around it, you can solve that activation energy problem with some social or financial lubricant, if you will, through new tokens.
Yeah, I'll take the other side of the argument. I feel like digital virtual network, it's the only competitive advantage that we are relying on there is network effects. When it comes to physical DeepIn networks, things like GeoNet, Helium, even though hard to bootstrap, there'll be a lot of failure rate, but the defensibility and network effects are twofold. Like, you get the network
effects. No, I agree. With physical, it's better.
I'm
saying the keyboard is a piece of DeepIn. It's like physical infrastructure.
Yes. Yes.
And how do you get the whole world to get a better keyboard? This is obviously a bit of a...
But if you do, then you have a monopoly, and it's tough. Tough for anybody to kind of enter.
But I do think that, again, everything in the free market or when you look at network effect issues, you have this tragedy of the commons in many cases. And I don't know if it's a tragedy of the commons, but it's hard to bootstrap people to move to a new standard. And one of the things crypto does well is motivate that by adding financial speculation as kind of the lubricant. And that happens both with social networks as well as hardware networks.
But then with token incentive, there's another thing which I call negative network effects. Where when the incentives dies out,
farm and dump and move on.
That's mercenary. That's why we also need the demand side to come in. And
that's why we need Barrachain for DeFi.
Yes.
Just to do a quick shill.
Do you have any hindsight regrets in some of the investments you passed on that became big? And what were some of the lessons there?
I won't go into names, but I'll say there was a window in around summer 2020 when things were heating up that I passed on a bunch of deals because I felt they were too expensive, although they were foundationally good tech and had a lot of promise. And those ended up being remarkably successful. Obviously, that was kind of macro driven and everything went parabolic in 2021. But generally, the thing I took away from that is that failure is not getting it wrong on deals. It's more so missing ones that you should have gotten, because the ones that work obviously pay for all the losers. This has always been the true axiom of venture capital finance. But you shouldn't fixate so much on narrow differences in valuation on whether you do a deal or do not do a deal. It's a little bit more of a binary, is this a yes or is it a no? And if it's a soft yes, maybe pass. But if you really like it, but you can't get there on valuation, you're probably not thinking big enough and this market will continue to grow. And being valuation sensitive is probably the biggest mistakes I've made. Not to say valuation doesn't matter, but...
And currently, do you kind of... still remain very disciplined on the valuation, or now you have realized that there is some flexibility and these are the criteria I will look at? You mentioned market size. if those criteria are fulfilled, I might have some leeway and flexibility in terms of my valuation that is desirable for investment. Like, what are your thoughts
there? There's so many factors that go into that. Like, it's going to be different with a smaller fund than a bigger fund, and the multiple you're trying to achieve is ultimately different. I think the valuations have to be grounded in reality, because obviously these tokens are highly liquid, and if you can get a much better deal in the liquid markets, you should do that as opposed to an overpriced venture round. Also, keep in mind, venture rounds tend to be inflated because, broader issue, all of the capital formation in crypto today is fundamentally venture driven. So there's often these displacements where, like, liquid tokens are a much better deal than venture. But because all of the organized capital is only mandated to invest in venture, we have to keep pumping new coins. And, like, these, again, they're market problems that'll solve in hopefully this cycle, maybe future cycles. But yeah, as long as it's anchored in reality, like, we don't nickel and dime founders. If we really, really like something, we'll do it, as long as it feels like a fair deal. But there's other issues with why like a early stage or pre-product token shouldn't be too expensive. Like, one, you actually have to distribute the tokens. Two, you have to launch at a low enough valuation that retail can actually make money. We see this issue with the last, like, several Binance launches, that the criticism is valid that retail isn't getting enough upside.
How do you prioritize and manage deal flow? With so many projects now in the space, and with your network, and you have been in crypto for a very long period of time, what's your process on managing these? And in terms of, just a rough estimate, in terms of researching about deals, doing DD, and maybe sourcing, how does that allocation also looks like? And as a percentage, yeah.
Yeah, I would say it all comes in spurts. I would say it's not like, if you start a fund and you have a four-year investment period, you're not doing like 25% of your deals in fund year one, 25 in year two, et cetera. It's kind of like there are bursts of time in crypto where there's a lot of innovation, a lot of capital formation. People are excited. Maybe some new research or some new paradigm came out, kind of the way like AI impacted crypto. And then you have a bunch of companies raising on that, and some truly being very innovative. So when that spurt comes, we sprint and we do a lot of deals aggressively, and we try to like time that appropriately, size that appropriately. And when it's quiet and you feel like the quality of deals isn't as high, people are mostly trying to raise on like Forkware or some copy pasta ideas, we're not as active. So we've been a little bit more passive recently. I think there was a lot of saturation in the first half of this year. Now we're a little bit more in harvest mode and wait and see. But when we are investing, I would say the trouble is like, you can't even diligence as many good opportunities as there are fast enough. And then for sometimes a couple of years, it's very dry and there's like nothing that seems too compelling. And I think just like having the patience to, if it's slow, don't rush it and don't make bad decisions, just wait. And if it's fast, don't get freaked out, just try to keep up and do the deals. If you have that discipline, I think you have good outcomes.
So earlier this year, there was explosion of deals. So when that type of momentum happens, how do you prioritize? Like, how do you manage? Because it kind of feels like there are not enough hours in the day.
Yeah, no, it's tough. I guess you have to rely on your team as much as possible. If you have a good rapport and good founder base, your founders sometimes are your biggest champions and deal scouts. So we have gotten deals through founders, quite a few. And it's like they're not the team, but they almost feel like an extension of the DAOFi family. Yeah, I just think... there's no great answer. It's tough. You just have to do your best.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you have to make time to touch grass, because you go crazy if all you do is crypto 24/7.
And in terms of your DD, like, how does the process look like? What do you over-index on? Like, speaking with the founder, spending time with them, looking at the deck, doing reference check? Like, how is that process for you?
Yeah, I think reference checks are very important. Like, founder integrity, trustworthiness is such an important thing in crypto. And we invest in Anons like we did with Barrachain, so it becomes even more important and harder to get a clear answer on sometimes. Technical capabilities and feasibility of what a technical spec is are also very, very important. We have like a very technical advisory board. Our extended founder base can really quickly vet things. And to Kyle, like, Kyle recently did a whole tweet on being a non-technical investor too, which I actually thought was interesting. And to one of his core points is like, any really novel tech idea, you'll find a very technical person who understands it that says it's feasible and one that says it's not feasible. So you don't like necessarily over-index on what certain domain experts think, because you'll find someone who believes in it and doesn't believe in it always, either way. But yeah, those are two of the important things. And the thing I spoke to earlier, like that cult of personality. Can you actually see a cult of personality forming around a founder? But if all of those check out, and then also what they're building has a big enough potential market size, I think it's a good deal.
And when you're doing reference check, is it mostly with other investors, your advisors, or is it even their previous projects they've either founded or companies they've worked at?
Bit of everything. I think all of those are important. And if they've had previous crypto projects, like was there a graceful transition of decentralized and handing over the keys to a community, or did they just kind of like rug and leave and do the next thing? That all goes into like the integrity calculation.
Going back to the ICOs that we were discussing earlier, what are your thoughts on ICOs, and do you think it will make a comeback?
So this is something VCs love to debate. Some people say, you know, ICOs were so much more pure. Things were better in those days. Look at the 2017, 2018 era ICOs. And sure, maybe they're not like top 10 anymore, but most of them have held their value better than these like overvalued VC coins that are doing low float, whatever. I think there's truth to that. At the same time, others will say, hey, that wasn't that egalitarian ever. Like, remember EOS ICO? Really skewed the market and it felt manufactured. Also, these are like click war races and gas races. So I think crowd sales fundamentally are very valuable. They work better at engaging a community of skin in the game retail than airdrops do. Airdrop, like holding airdrops is a very thankless game. Like you can basically never make the community happy. It's just about how much you don't upset them in a way. Like they're going to be upset either way. So I think in some form, ICOs hopefully return. I do think they're the purest form of price discovery and bootstrapping a network. But as I mentioned earlier, like every cycle, the form of token distribution changes. Goes from ICOs to yield farming to NFT sales, like people are doing node sales now. There's all kind of ways to dress it, but fundamentally the problem is too many VC dollars in these projects, not enough retail dollars at an early stage.
Infrastructure versus dApps. Do you feel like value is moving up the stack, and with your new fund, there could be a potential that more focus might be on dApps versus infrastructure? Like, what are your thoughts there in general?
I think generally it can be misleading or a bit of a false dichotomy. Like, a lot of projects are both bespoke infrastructure that they're built on, like they're running their own L2 on OP stacks.
If you believe in the modular thesis.
Yeah, fair. If you believe in the modular thesis.
That's the assumption behind
it. In Solana land, they're just one or the other. It's binary. But I do think that the point of like, okay, we've invested in enough quote unquote generic or generalized infrastructure. If you're building infra today just because you think it's faster or like you can have a higher TPS, that's not as captivating. There's enough teams working on this, enough capital chasing that. The thing that really matters now is how do you onboard new users and provide some useful experience to them. I think if users just want to speculate or send financial payments, it's very easy to do that in crypto already. Maybe there's some better UX unlocks, but one of the reasons why Telegram is so interesting and the TON community has been so fervorous this year is they have 1 billion users and they're very, very active. The early apps that are building on Telegram, they've had like in the millions of DAUs where it's hard to find any other type of crypto app that has those numbers.
What are your pet peeve in crypto? People? I feel like there's so many that you had to take a beat. I was like, let me revalidate
this. Well, it's just people tend to just chase what is the shiniest object at any given time. And like most of the crypto industry doesn't believe in anything, has no real conviction in anything. They're just like herd creatures. And you can feel the like pressure when you're not doing it. Like, you know, the people speculate VCs are now going to have to chase meme coins because they have to explain to their LPs why they're not catching goat level returns and stuff like that. And again, like I respect the investors and history has proven the ones that do the best, both as builders or investors, are ones that just like believe in something and have conviction. They're not just chasing the herd or like a part of the herd.
Do you think that's your investing edge as well? Not chasing the herd? How would you define your investing edge? Like, no. Every investor contemplates this late at night.
Yes. And we talked about this a little bit where like, I don't know if I have one. It can be hard to look back and distinguish between skill and luck. And where did the skill end? When did the luck begin? Do you even have skill? Was it all luck? But we've been fortunate that the portfolio has turned out well. I think the best way to kind of like reconcile all of that internally is don't over focus on you were skillful, because then you start to believe you have like the Midas touch and everything you do will turn out well. You don't question yourself enough. You, it leads to bad outcomes. You end up losing money. If you think you were just purely lucky, you basically shatter your self-confidence and end up also maybe too timid to deploy capital, too risk off, end up not making money. So for me, some of the things that we've tried to focus on is integrity, like really just doing right by founders. We almost have like no conflicts in our portfolio. Like every relationship with every founder we have is a net positive. And sometimes like you have to turn away easy, quick money and do the right thing. We try to be early. We try to just help as much as it's possible in the hard times. So I think like a token launches on Binance, $10 billion valuation. Every investor is coming out of the woodwork to reach out and congratulate you and try to do more with you. But when it's not in the money and things are having hard times, like which founders are going to, or which funds are going to roll up their sleeves and help the founders? Those are the moments we try to focus on.
Tegan, I feel like there is a theme here. The way you got into crypto and Polychain was through helping founders. And I kind of feel like having this conversation, I think there's a lot of focus on the founder, like helping them out, getting your deal flows from other founders, referral. So I kind of feel like one of your edges is just being very close with the founders and helping them think through different.
Well, they're the star players. Like I don't actually make the money for the fund like the founders do by creating valuable products and creating valuable technology. So my job is just to be of service and be there with them. That's what we try to do. And part of that is like an ego check thing. Again, we're relatively quiet. It may impact our brand perception sometimes, but that's a deliberate trade-off. I think just highlighting the portfolio and then kind of being of quiet service is the best way.
How do you evaluate? So one thing with investment is the decisions to maybe double down or triple down in subsequent rounds. And defensibility and competitive advantages plays a role in those decisions. How do you evaluate defensibility and competitive advantage in general in Web3? What are some of those moats or defensibility elements that you look for in protocol or projects, apart from the quality of the founder?
It's such a good question because crypto is such a different environment, right? Like it's fundamentally, the majority of the tech is open source. So there's not really an IP moat. It's very rapid, so there's not even that much of like a first mover moat. Like people can launch and fork and move quickly. And there's this broader question of like, where does defensibility come from at all in that type of environment? And for every Uniswap, there'll be a SushiSwap type play if it's successful. But in the fullness of time, like the thing that matters the most is community. And I know it's like, I keep hammering back everything to community, but like when you look at what has survived and what's lasted, that has always been the consistent theme. Often building really novel, inventive tech will lead to that, but it's not sufficient in and of itself. And we've seen that with certain projects.
So would you classify community as equivalent of being a brand that kind of gives you that defensibility?
Sorry, repeat that.
So in terms of defensibility, would you say community in crypto Web3 is the equivalent of being a brand in Web2?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think so. Because what does a brand mean even in like the consumer world? Like what does McDonald's brand or any brand mean? And trust is a big thing. Like people go to McDonald's because wherever you are in the world, the experience is identical. Like there's that consistency, which is why I think that cult of personality is the first thing you see in a lot of these crypto networks. The second factor that stands out is how trustworthy is this personality. You rug once, network's dead. Like I invested in Spell, if you remember Spell from 2021.
Yes.
And like the day later that that like known scammer came out as one of the anonymous founders and stuff, and it like killed the token price at overnight at least. So trust is the real currency. It's also why Ethereum has done so incredibly well, because Vitalik is like a true missionary. He's not a mercenary. The trust and integrity perception in the market of him is so ridiculously high. He has like the equivalent of an Elon Musk halo. Like he talks about an asset, it'll pump or whatever. He doesn't really use that for financial gain, but I think that is the most common thing.
Yeah, just talking about OHM folks, right? Like I remember there was one called Rome. They kind of pivoted and they returned the money. So I was just thinking about that, just random thought.
I don't think I saw Rome. I saw Temple DAO and Kalima.
Yeah, so I think Rome was on I think Moonbeam or Polkadot. They were the OHM equivalent of that in Polkadot. Nice. And I think when things didn't work out, they just returned the treasury, and they returned the
See, that's good. Like, I think that more case studies like that and more precedents where, you know, DAO doesn't find product market fit, doesn't rug all of the users, returns capital, does its best to fairly distribute resources, that's going to embolden people to participate in these communities more actively. I think in 2021, there were a bunch of like social DAOs that raised at billion-dollar valuations, and that makes it harder to get adoption because it's hard to grow into that valuation or even exceed it in the future. Again, like, I fall back on this progressive decentralization idea. And even if you were to start a new L1 today, realistically, it's going to be progressive decentralization as well. You're going to start with, like, you run 1,000 instances of miners on, like, AWS or validators on AWS, and then slowly get more community people to run them, and the foundation runs less. It's hard to start purely decentralized today. Even Ethereum had to go through this, like, these growing pains. So I think it's the best approach to DAOs.
Do you think... on a protocol level, decentralization and progressive decentralization makes sense. But let's say on DApp level, let's assume you're talking about monolithic. Do you feel like on DApp side of things, does decentralization matter as such? Especially if you're making equity, like the token is kind of like quasi-equity, you're giving dividends, you're doing buyback and burn. Does decentralization, progressive decentralization even matter in those cases?
I think it's case by case. Depends on what the app does. Say it's some pure social thing and you don't actually care where the front end is hosted, if it's hosted by some company or like what the database of your usage looks like. Is it just on the servers of this one company? As long as, like, if there's a financial component, the financial assets underneath the hood are secured on a decentralized blockchain and that's censorship resistant. There's different ways you can draw that up, but it ties down to what the use case is.
What's your favorite investor or a fund in Web3 and why?
Not including myself. Well, I learned the most from Olaf, obviously. I think Olaf was definitely a huge visionary. A lot of my thinking about, like, focusing on quiet service, not as much like publishing as much necessarily, some of that has been modeled on him. He's also not a herd creature. Like, he has his own views and his own conviction. I think Framework, Vance and Michael, similarly, they have their own conviction, and I respect that when you make, like, big contrarian bets. Kyle from Multicoin as well. I actually like a lot of the other funds. I think there's great people in all of them, and even if we don't have the same view of the world or the same portfolio, different funds, bags, they're good too.
Yeah, all great funds. So let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about outside of Web3. What are some of the hobbies outside of crypto you enjoy or partake in?
I've been spending a lot of time on boxing. I'm pretty bad still, but I really enjoy it. I think it's a great way to detach and at least get off crypto Twitter for a little while. And chess. I love chess. I played in, like, a crypto chess tournament in 2021 and went to the semifinals and made this, like, really bad move and got checkmated. But yeah, I think it's important to have these interests and to exercise the, like, learning muscle in your brain as well is very important because you lose that neuroplasticity as you age. So I try
to read a lot.
Yeah, I try to. But I try to read more than tweets and white papers and emails. Like, that's the challenge. But I'm trying to read more books.
Yeah, I think that's I was speaking with Jack about this as well. I think just focusing and reading now has become an edge because the way we live in with so much social media and so many things to pay attention to and how quickly the things pass by, just finding 5 hours, 4 hours a day and just, like, reading and doing research is edge, I feel.
Yeah, and also, like, you need to detach a little bit from it, which is why I don't envy anyone that's a pure crypto trader. Because if you're, like, we all see the price every moment of the day and it can stress you out, but at least when you're, like, doing venture and you have long time horizons, you don't have to be as impacted by it. I don't envy traders for that reason. I think, with the exception of traders, like, detaching and not paying attention to what people are talking about and crypto price and just thinking first principles for yourself, that's a huge edge.
Yeah. Also, the way modern life is structured, right? Like, with social media, like with TikTok or Instagram, you have Instagram stories, you have TikTok clips. clips and reels for like 20 seconds, 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And then you have YouTube with like 5. It's very easy to kind of doom scroll and
yeah.
I feel like just sitting down and thinking and just reading
right.
can give you
also all of our like neurochemistry is completely fucked. Sorry to
yeah,
say
is, it.
It
is.
you need to like reset your dopamine baseline.
Yes.
And that means time away from all social media. But also things like fasting and sleeping and like having a very slow detached day.
Are there any things you do to kind of reset your dopamine?
Yeah. I like twice a year I go to this like detox clinic type of thing where there's generally no phones, no laptops allowed. It's hard to get away and like obviously be totally detached for a week, but I think it's very important. You come back feeling much lighter, much more nimble. Your clarity of thought is much better. But it's a challenge. It's a challenge for all of us. You have to like balance it internally of like what's the appropriate amount to be chronically online versus like sane. And those two things can be at odds sometimes.
What's a defining moment in your life that changed your approach to investing and life in general?
You know, it's really interesting. I recently saw like an astrologer and apparently like it's a very renowned astrologer who consults with very, very like important people in business and politics, etc. And they were able to dial down like critical moments in my life just by looking at my star chart. And
what's a star, by the way?
I'm a Gemini. I was born May 25th, but there's more. I've learned that there's more into that, like the time of birth and exactly where you were born. All of this stuff matters. And I don't know if like to what extent I believe it really, but I do like to embrace that we don't know everything. Like when you feel very smart, you tend to lose some of that wisdom and you get too cocky as humans, because fundamentally we don't know anything. Like the universe is so vast. And so there's been a few defining moments. I think like career-wise, that first decision in 2017. And it's funny because as a corporate lawyer, like the reason people go to law school is because they're so risk averse. You want that certainty to know that there will always be this industry. It's like a relatively safe profession and safe way to grow your income. But like coming to terms that I had spent 3 years in law school, accrued all the student debt, and then I was going to leave in less than 2 years, like less time than I spent in law school. I was a lawyer. I think that was a pivotal moment and like kind of quitting and just bouncing around crypto. But it wasn't a hard decision for me. It felt very intuitive. It's just like, usually that's a sign. If you have very, very irrational conviction in something and that's not a normal trend for you, then you should embrace it and pursue that.
Is there advice for young Web3 investors getting into the space? Do you have any advice for them?
I think similarly to what I did with law, like focus on some core skill that you can bring to the table. It doesn't have to be even a degree or a specific profession as a background. But if you're just like the community guy that's very active in DAO governance and you're just a regular person, but you're messaging and you're constantly participating, that's alpha. Like there's so many forms of alpha because crypto is vast. No company or fund manager or founder can cover everything. But focus on having that one skill and then like have the depth with one thing and then the breadth with everything. Like then consume everything. Learn about all the tokens, all the communities, all the founders. But yeah, combining those two, like I think people sometimes specialize too much or they're just kind of a floating generalist over everything.
Yes.
But having like a bit of both is very key. And then also try to join when it's like not a herd mentality. Like there's years in crypto's history, like 2018, everyone rushed in because of the 2017 boom. And then like 2021, everyone rushed in because they saw what was happening in the financial assets. And
yeah, I'll tell you my story, how I got into crypto. 2020, I couldn't invest through Interactive Broker because during COVID, there was a lot of volatility. I came from emerging market. They deplatformed me. And then I saw Synthetics. I saw Mirror Protocol during that time. I was like, holy shit. You can invest 24/7, no need for KYC. I'm from Pakistan, I can invest, amazing. So for me, that was the aha moment.
I love it, yeah, no. That was intuitive to me too. I all of the like wrapped security stuff I think is super interesting. It's actually like better. It's price discovery 24/7. People can speculate overnight when the markets are closed. There's a lot of reasons why it's preferable.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people are missing out. Like I would, people in emerging market, frontier market would love to get exposure to, let's say, Tesla, but they can't because of some of the barriers, because
right.
of regulatory reasons and things like that. So I think it's a massive, and once you kind of see that, you kind of feel like all the platforms out there are are vulnerable.
Yeah. No, I totally agree.
And they can also deplatform you anytime.
Yes.
Like, nobody can take your
Ethereum censor keys. And skew the markets. Like, Wall Street Bets went through this when
yes.
you were only allowed to sell your AMC and
yes.
you weren't allowed to buy. And I think that was like a kind of collective aha moment. Yeah. That's when the regular retail investor was
just
like...
It's not just even the businesses. It's governments as well, right? Mm-hmm. Like, for me in 2018, Pakistani government kind of froze my dad's account. And I was studying at Cambridge University. And yeah, I couldn't continue my education because all the money was frozen. So you kind of realize that with these platforms, one nuanced risk is anybody can be deplatformed.
Yep.
So for me, that was kind of aha moment. The decentralization and permissionless part is I think, a big unlock and a nuanced unlock that a lot of people don't appreciate.
Yep. Especially in the first world, you don't appreciate it because it hasn't happened to you.
Yeah.
But that's also why I think like the developing world, other parts of the world are first movers in really adopting the values of crypto in terms of using it as money. It's similar to privacy in my thesis where, like, again, until it impacts you, you don't realize how important it is.
You're raising right now for DAO 5. Tips for raising a Web3 fund, like, what are some of the key variables to optimize? What are some of the things? Just hacks and life lessons you have learned whilst raising.
It's much harder than it used to be. You need a unique story. There's also like hundreds, if not probably over 1,000 crypto VCs now. It's not like 2017 when there was like a handful or like single digit numbers. So just really figure out like what your story is. Similarly, if you're a protocol founder or a fund manager, you have to do the same exercise, which is create some distinction from the rest of the market. Find out what you're good at, what makes you different, and just tell that story convincingly. The other part is like you obviously need, it's a very quantifiable science. Like you could see people's returns and who's done a good job. So hopefully after the first fund is like the make or break test. It should get easier, and it's definitely getting easier for us.
In fundraising, does cold outreach help, or is it mostly referral through your network?
I think both, but our base is very like friends and family. Like I think there's warm relationships with all of our LP base, and it's quite concentrated, so it's not like other funds that have hundreds of LPs.
So Taken, if you could go back in time and give your younger self some advice when you first entered crypto space, what would that advice be?
Yeah, so I came in 2017, and I think the advice I would give is really just focus on making your mark on the space. Like chasing money is one thing, or chasing a good job or whatever else is fine, but there's not many opportunities in life when you'll join a movement or a technology or an industry so young that you can actually impact it forever. So I think I did little bits of that in my own way. As an example, like we started doing some of the first SAFT contracts and token warrants at Polychain. I think a deal we co-led with A16Z was actually the first time the token warrant was used. And in almost all the token warrants today, if you look at like the standard language, there's some stuff in there that I had made up and free drafted in 2017 when I was kind of a junior lawyer and had no idea what I was doing, but the contract was very new. So it's cool to see that like little piece of contribution towards the history. The term is related entities, by the way, if you're curious, in a token warrant. The next time you sign one, I made that up in 2017.
Very cool.
So I think if you think in terms of what can I contribute to this space instead of what can I take out of it, you'll end up reaping the rewards anyways. But it'll be more fulfilling if you see your mark. So that is something I would have focused on a little bit more instead of stressing about like the investments and some of the financials, I guess.
So you have seen a lot of contracts. You've seen a lot of term sheet. Has there been any, again, not to disclose name, is there a term sheet that you recall issued by someone that just had like funny clauses and that you thought were like, oh wow, this is very unique and slightly disturbing?
Do you know something? Because there's a funny story here. I don't know if you know this. Okay, I'll give a little bit of a fun story. At one point with the Barrachain founders, I was like deep in a negotiation about some stuff in the contract, and it was the tone was getting a little bit tense, and I remember just going back and forth with Papa and Smokey, and we were kind of at an impasse, and I was like, you know what? To lighten the mood, I'm going to like propose something funny. So we put some language in a side letter that says if certain metrics are hit for the fund on the bear chain investment, I'm going to get a Bong Bears tattoo on my body. So that's literally in the contract today. And
that's very cool.
Yeah, it's fun. It's like you kind of do it for the lore. And it worked, though. It lightened the mood. We like had a laugh, and then we started negotiating and managed to get a deal done. So
I think this is what I'm going to put on the intro video of the podcast.
Okay. I like it. Okay, good.
So, Dakin, before we conclude the podcast, what's a question I should have asked you but didn't?
We didn't double-click much on this kind of common dialogue or dichotomy of crypto, of like meme coins versus infra and the financial nihilism that comes with that. But I just think like one thing I would emphasize when speaking about the value of tech coins, even though it's unpopular right now and people are upset with the last token launches, is we are moving towards this path of protocol profitability and the market valuing that. To like look at MakerDAO today, for instance, the thing has like $150 million of annual earnings, trading at a $1 billion market cap. To comp that to like a meme coin or even other infra tokens that don't have any earnings but are trading at huge multiples of that, I think at some point the market has to grow up and we have to keep developing frameworks for how we value tokens. And it's interesting because this happened in 2017. Like people, as we were talking about it before, the FAT protocol thesis by Joe Monegro and Chris Bernisky did some stuff around the value of the velocity of money and how you value tokens like that. And maybe these in the short term didn't prove to be true, any of these theses, or they were just kind of like building blocks on how we think of this. But that work feels like it hasn't continued. And since COVID and since like 2021, there's been a lot of financial nihilism. This isn't unique to crypto. People think even in the stock world, like earnings don't matter anymore. All that matters is the story you could tell. But again, this is very short history. I think starting to develop strong frameworks for valuing tokens is going to be key. And this is something we want to be a big part of and start to share our ideas around this more in the coming years.
Yeah. This is something I've also been thinking a lot about. My mental model is, especially on the DeFi and DeepIn side, can you do a DCF? Mm-hmm. And if it's a middleware or L1, the degree of moneyness it has. So it doesn't need to have all the attributes of money. If you are paying a premium, apart from the technology, the degree of moneyness it has is important. But on the protocol side, on the dApp side, it's basically 10 years, 20 years down the road, does the DCF make sense?
Right. Yeah. And the only reason we all play this game is we're like, we have an adverse SEC engaged in lawfare, but I think, again, these governments are there for 4 years. We have an election tomorrow. So who knows? By the time we watch this podcast, it could be a very different environment.
Dakin, it was a pleasure to have you on. I learned a lot. And yeah, it was a very common theme that you are very strong on the portfolio support side of things. So yeah, it was great to have you on board. And yeah, it was great chatting with you. And I learned a lot.
Thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.